Come sing for us anytime you can. For the past 3 years, I believe it's been now, we've had a Sunday service here in either late October or early November, in which we observe and celebrate the Day of the Dead, a holiday that has its origins in Mexico and other parts of Central America. And as I came to educate myself about this holiday, I found, first of all, the juxtaposition of kind of celebration and festivity and colors and banners and all that thing on the one hand, with the remembrance of persons who had died on the other, as a little odd. But my quick follow-on thought to that was that it's really no more odd than our mixed bag of our home, than the mixed bag that our homegrown American Memorial Day weekend has become. We largely use it to herald the arrival of summer, the onset of a time when maybe, hopefully, we can downshift just a little bit the pace of our lives. The picnics and the cookouts and the long weekend trips, particularly here in New England, I think they're also a way of finally and really and truly marking the end of winter's grip on us for another year. It has kind of a real kickback sort of have fun, joie de vivre kind of flavor about it. But then it is also a time when we are supposed to remember and honor persons who have died. The origins of the holiday in this country are the Civil War, or the post-Civil War era, as our country attempted to heal from the wounds of that horrible conflict by setting aside a day to honor lives that were lost on both sides. And since one of the human tragedies is that we have yet to wage a war to end all wars, the holiday has continued time to honor those lives that have been lost in conflicts fought since then. And then over the years, the scope of this holiday has expanded even more to where it's become a day of remembrance of all of those who touched and blessed our lives and who have now passed on. So as I thought about how the Day of the Dead is observed and how our Memorial Day is observed, I saw that they've all kind of become something of the same thing. I can see that for all the differences in how these two holidays are celebrated, there's a common theme in their pairing a kind of festivity in life while also paying heed and being mindful of the very fragile and transitory nature of life. Indeed, these two holidays are the two expressions of a larger and more universal human theme and need, which is to both savor life and acknowledge death. So perhaps it's not so odd the way that doing both of those come together on the same holiday. My earliest memories of this weekend combine those two aspects, actually. When I was a kid, the school calendar was such that Memorial Day signaled the end of the school year, for which there was no greater cause for rejoicing if you were of a certain age. And until I was in my early teens, this was also the weekend it meant for me that I went from this transition from being with my family, my sisters, and my mother and father at our home near Charleston, West Virginia, and I got to go down to my grandfather's farm in southern Ohio for the weekend. So on that much-anticipated Sunday, my parents, my sisters, and I, we would drive from our home near Charleston out to a very rural area of that state where my father had grown up. And there'd be a combination party, family reunion of a bunch of different families that lived out in that part of the woods, that part of the country, and a general feast that was held on the lawn of a little country Baptist church just off the side dirt road. There we would be met by my grandfather, my aunts, my uncles from Ohio, and I would move my stuff from their car, from our car to their car, and take off to their place for the summer when the day was over. Their small farm. I was the only kid on the place. And I would be shamelessly spoiled for 3 months. And my sisters had to go back home. This is something that the oldest of those three sisters has not let me forget to this very day. Sibling rivalry dies hard. Let me tell you. It does. But in keeping with the dual nature of this holiday, at some point in those gatherings, you were supposed to break from the festivities that were going on the church lawn there and go up this little cemetery on the hill about a half a mile away and bring the flowers that you had brought with them, put them by the gravesides of your families and say a little prayer over them. And the day was not really done. The day was not properly observed until you had done that. Over the years since those days, I noticed a slight shift in mood on my part when it comes to Memorial Day. It's become a little more pensive than it used to be. Maybe that's just because of the aging process. Don't get me wrong, I still have a good time. Except we had a great party in here yesterday. I still have a lot of that childlike anticipation of the summer that I guess I never lost. But maybe my pensiveness, I think it probably has to do with seeing now and then someone who's roughly my own age or maybe just a little bit older pass away. Some of you knew Clark Hill, some of you did not. He and his family moved on before a number of you joined. But I'll be doing a service for him next Sunday. And his family's wishes it'll be at a home in Dunstable. Clark and his wife Jo moved north quite a few years ago to open up a bed and breakfast country, sort of up in the Lakes region, I believe, which means many of you did not get to know him. But he was a very cheerful, upbeat kind of a guy. And on those occasional times when he would speak up during our joys and concerns, it would always be to give a positive account the ongoing struggle with cancer that he had. He could joke about it when he lost his hair and then joke about it when it came back again. Now the time has come for me to work with or to be with his family and friends in taking the full measure of his life. I don't mean to be morbid about all this, and I trust, I hope you're not taking it that way. It's just that I now find my Memorial Day musings going more in the direction of how does one take the measure of a life, particularly as I sometimes am thinking about my own. I don't do much speculating about an afterlife, because that's all it can ever really be, speculation. Maybe we do have some form of continuing existence beyond our life on Earth, in some form or other. I seriously doubt it involves the kind of individual consciousness and awareness that we carry throughout our earthly lives. And with all due respect to some of my more orthodox believer friends and even some family members, I really don't believe that the full and final meaning of this life is to get into some next one, whatever that next one might be. It is not, as I see it, where, if anywhere, we go, but rather what we leave gives our lives their meaning and their fulfillment. Will other lives, be they many or be they a few, feel more blessed, more strengthened, more hopeful, more fulfilled because of how your life touched theirs? And will this earth and this world, even if it is in the smallest of ways, be a more blessed and hopeful and sane and just place for our having spent some time here, expending some of our energies? I think it is how we answer these questions over the course of our lives that give our lives their deepest meaning. And if the ways in which we answer those questions are also some part of some greater overarching purpose and meaning for life itself, well and good, we are fulfilling that purpose too. Having conducted the number of memorial services and funerals that I now have, I feel fortunate in a way to have gained what I feel is a pretty good understanding of some of the more specific ways in which the measure of a life is taken and what the marks of a full life are. So for the remainder of my sermon today, I want to share what I have gleaned, what some of those measures are. And then I want to move the focus to the lives of two very fine members of our congregation who passed away this past year, and say a little about what I think the marks, some of the more significant marks of their lives were. I know I've spoken before on the topic of the kinds of things that are most remembered in a person's life when they passed away, so I'm just going to very briefly revisit that here for a few minutes. One thing I've always found striking, talking with a family at the paramemorial service, is how little attention is usually given to how the deceased person earned their living, or how well they did financially, I say that's a little odd because that's what we devote a substantial chunk of our lives to. The job or the profession will be mentioned. It will be always, it will sometimes be affirmed. It's not demeaned or put down. But it is rather instead the ways in which the person extended him or herself to others, whether on the job or in other settings, is what really gets the emphasis. It is how the person gave of him or herself to their family and their friends, their community, their religious community, just to life itself. That's remembered far more than what they managed to acquire. As I said, nobody's material worth is ever belittled or demeaned. It just doesn't get top billing. Closely related to this, it's the things you're most passionate about, things you're most devoted to, the things you most care about, and how that comes through in your life. Those are things that are most remembered. I recall doing a service with someone who had been instrumental. Name escapes me. I couldn't think of the names. I was writing this down. But someone who had been instrumental in promoting softball and tennis programs for children and young people here in Nashville. And the tournaments he'd gotten in the city to host and the teams he had gotten together and taken to out-of-town tournaments for their softball or tennis. The man's job was barely mentioned. But his passion for sports, these kinds of sports, was related at length. Message there, I get it. It's whatever you feel most passionate about. Whether it's got anything to do with your job or not, that's what's going to show through. That's what's going to be remembered. It's one very significant way in which the measure of your life will be taken. And you're also going to be remembered for the ways in which you make people laugh. And I don't mean by that how good your jokes are. You wouldn't want to rely on that piece of it to do that. Yeah. What I'm saying instead is you're going to be remembered for the kind of joy that you brought to other people's lives. You'll be remembered for how you lightened and lifted other people's spirits when they most needed it. That's another marker that I've seen commonly referred to in the services, the memorial services I've provided. And you're also going to be measured for how at home you were with yourself, how grounded you were, for how clear you were in your convictions, even as you allow space for others of differing convictions than your own. You'll be marked and remembered for how well you carried yourself with an inner confidence. Not an inflated ego, but an inner confidence. That's another often cited measure of a life. And you'll be remembered and measured for how religious you were. Now, this may sound a little strange, especially since I am the minister in town who often gets called upon when a family goes to a funeral service and says, well, our family member or friend here was not very religious, but we still want a minister to come and officiate the service. That's when the funeral director says, well, I guess I better call the local UU minister here. Never fails. So I get that call, I meet with the family, and more often than not, I'll start hearing some things about how the deceased person loved and savored life, savored living, respected the earth and its creatures, or cultivated a sense of awe and mystery and wonder, this larger life that's all around us, that surrounds us, and I'll sit there and I'll listen to all that. I'll find myself thinking, although I usually keep the words to myself, I'll find myself thinking, well, this person sounds pretty religious to me. But whether you care to call it religious or not, how well you embraced and loved and savored, gave up yourself to life, will be a very clear marker in taking the measure of your days. And so with these kinds of markers and measures in mind, I'd like to turn our attention now to two of our members whose lives can certainly be measured and thought of very well against these, whom many of us, I know, still miss very much. Now, Sheila Burley, Don Rowley. We held a service of remembrance for Sheila back in early January, following her death just before Christmas. I'm not going to replicate that service here, other than to say that it was her cheerful nature that was well remembered, along with the smile that she managed to have for almost everyone, no matter what her own feelings or situation was. Remember what I said about lightening people's spirits and lifting their life up? She did a lot of that. We remember her deep sense of devotion to her friends and relatives, both nearby and in England. We remember her especially strong sense of love and devotion to her church, particularly the joy she took in hearing our choir sing. And the thing that stayed with me over the months since Sheila's death was the way in which she approached it, and how in concert it was with how she lived her overall life, at least her overall life as I and many of you had come to know it. At first, it looked like she was going to recover from a lung collapse. And then she had a very severe relapse about a day or so after, things were looking pretty good. And at that point, Sheila, in that sort of rather British, matter-of-fact way of hers that always undergirded her cheerful demeanor, just made two very matter-of-fact wishes. I do not wish to be treated for this collapse any longer, this lung collapse any longer. Things will just have to take their course from here. And the church could have the contents of my apartment to do with as they wish. And then she just let it go. In a way quite consistent with the life she led, she knew who she was. She knew what she wanted. She knew how she wanted things done. And she didn't want to hear any different. She had savored the life that had been hers to live, and she'd extended that life to many others in ways none of us will probably ever fully know. And then when she was ready to let it go and felt there was no more worth savoring, she'd given it all she had. And so I honor her, and I bless her for the way in which she lived and for the manner in which she chose to lead his life. Don Rowley lived just one floor below Sheila over at the Hunt community. In mid-March, I called him up, asked if he would come here to be a part of the Friday night segment of that social justice workshop we did right there at the end of March, early the first beginning of April. I asked if he could come on that Friday night, because the Friday night was when we did a timeline of our congregation's history of community outreach and social justice efforts, and since Don had been a part of all that for 3 decades, I thought it would be very good to have him come and share some of his thoughts and memories of that, and he was very glad to do that. He agreed to do that. He was planning to come. And then he very suddenly, as you know, passed away a few days before the workshop was held. Most of you have seen, either in our May newsletter or on our church's website, the letter to the congregation of Don's sons, Phil and Dana, sent as to why they felt duty-bound to honor their father's wishes that no public memorial service for Don be held. And I know from my conversations with them, that was not an easy decision for them to make. In fact, they agonized over it, because they knew how important Don's life had been to so many other people. But in the end, they said they were at peace with the knowledge that they had made the right call. As they put it, they wanted to get it right one last time for their father in doing what he had said and what he had told them to do, recalling some of the times when they said they hadn't always done it. And so I had to respect their decision. I also believe Don would thank both them and me and all of us for respecting and honoring his wishes in the way that we have. I know also that Don was a fierce defender, a fierce devotee of the free pulpit, a freedom which he exercised on this very spot with integrity and fight. thoughtfulness for 29 years. So I don't doubt that he would regard it well within the free pulpit prerogative I now had if I were to offer a brief tribute to him as part of my Memorial Day service in this year of his passing. For all of his low-key, sort of stay-in-the-background kinds of ways, Don also carried a very steady pride with him, that sort of inner confidence that I referred to earlier. And I saw these two attributes of his come together back in May of 2000 when he was presented with the National Charitable Foundation's Humanitarian Award for service in this community. Before Don spoke, John Sias got up and gave a citation. And he recounted the many ways in which Don, in the course of his ministry here and his life in this community, greatly enhanced the quality of life, raised the level of social justice here at Nashville. He founded the Mental Health Committee, which gave rise to our community council, which gives mental health services to persons who could not otherwise afford it. He organized the National Family Planning Association to make birth control more available at a time when that was a very controversial issue. He organized the National Fair Housing Practices Committee to advocate for racial, for affordable and available housing in our community across racial lines, when that was also a very controversial and divisive issue. And on, John Sias went with this, from Don's efforts on behalf of Harvard Homes, getting that going, Big Brother, Big Sister, Community Hospice, the Adult Learning Center, all of that. Neat citation and notation did call out to be mentioned because of Don's devotion to it. And then Don got his chance to speak. Completely in character. First words out of his mouth were, "I'm not sure I'm deserving of this award." But then he went on to say, "But I believe the generation I represent is." And he took it from there. For all of his low-key ways, Don was proud, very rightly proud, of the service that he and all of his fellow servicemen, servicewomen in uniform, gave to his country in the Second World War. And he was equally proud of the ways in which so many of them, like himself, came home to serve their communities and to serve the greater good of responding to human need and human justice here. For Don and many of his fellow veterans, fighting for freedom and democracy in a struggle that really was about freedom and democracy and justice, and then coming home to work on the still unfulfilled aspects of those things here. For him, that was all part of the same plot, all part of the same piece. And so when he accepted that award, he really said he was accepting on behalf of the generation that he represented. And I was very proud of him for that. Did I lose this? All right, let's turn this one on. Turn this one on. Thank you. And then in later years, late 60s and early 70s, it was Don's service in the Army and his risking his life in the 103rd Infantry in France and Germany that I'm sure gave his public opposition to the war in Vietnam all that much more depth and integrity and validity. Because for Don, it was an expression of the very same patriotism and the very same devotion to duty he had shown over 20 years prior when he put on the uniform of his country and took up arms on its behalf. For all of his public life, beyond these walls, beyond this religious community, I'm sure Don is most remembered for how he quietly and compassionately went about the work of ministry with the congregation here that he loved. And I know there's more stories of his caring presence and how that was experienced than can ever be told. His challenging, his deeply thought-provoking, and sometimes just plain-provoking, as I'm told, sermons still have their effect. He and I were very close in our thinking in a number of ways, even as our religious and spiritual orientations differed slightly than others. Such is the beauty I feel of our Unitarian Universalist ministry. But each minister is given the freedom to speak and live out the truth as she or he sees it in each of our congregations. And I remember one of the first congregations Don and I had as I began my ministry here. I thought it would be a good thing to call on my predecessor and get to know him and chat a little bit, especially since he had preceded me with 29 years. And in the course of that conversation, Don gave me the only piece of advice I can ever remember him giving. But we were talking about how you make an impact, how you exercise your influence on both the congregation you serve and the community in which your congregation is located. And at one point in that conversation, Don said, "Well, it's a good idea to make sure you have some influence before you decide to start throwing it around." Very good point. For Don knew how to gather and to accumulate his influence. And he didn't just throw it around. He knew how to use it where it would count the most, as he did for the nearly three decades that he served this church and this community. And just one more thing for me to add on a personal level, which I feel I need to say above all else. Don was a model, was a model par excellence for what it meant to graciously hand off a ministry to a successor minister. When it was time to let it go, he let it go. He knew that this influence of his, of which I just spoke, he knew that would well outlast his called ministry here with this church. But he was determined that such influence would not in any way hinder the ministry of whoever would come after him. It actually took a little convincing on my part to get him to accept the designation as our minister emeritus. He was very proud to get it, but he also wanted to be assured by me that honoring him in such a way would not be any kind of a stumbling block, any kind of ministry I was doing here. Such, again, was Don's nature. That was the way he was. I didn't see how it could, but I offered him that assurance nonetheless. And I know there will come a day, we're not there yet, there will come a day when I too will hand off this ministry to another. Whenever that time comes, I could not have had a better example of how to do it with grace and honor than the example that Don has given me. So on this Memorial Day week, I bless, I honor, I give thanks for his life, his memory, his ministry here, his devotion to his community. And on this Memorial Day week, even as we celebrate the arrival of summer, let us also bless and honor and give thanks for all those lives that have touched and blessed our own and that have now moved to another realm. The late Robert Zorheide, in a reading I sometimes use in memorial services, wrote, "Death is the change that comes between where we are and where the universe is. Our lives, that is to say, are part of a larger, greater, continuing life of the universe that contains and unfolds us all. And we're given a little piece of time. In that little piece of time that we are given, in the timelessness of the universe itself, let us live out that piece of time in a way that others will be deeply thankful for when we hand it off. Now let's sing together, "Thanks Be to These."